Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chelly.
May 12, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this, indeed, is the show you were looking for. How do I know this? Because you're hearing me say what I'm saying. Thursday, the second to last broadcast day of the week for the O'Chelly Effect. And we got a few more tricks up our sleeve before the week is over. But I am so happy that I've got my regular people back on Thursday because we got many things to discuss. A surprise in the second hour from Larry Hancock. Who knows? We may have to add it to JFK Myths episodes. I don't know. I'm almost inspired to get back to that. And maybe you guys will give me a little feedback. Let me know if we should continue that trend here on the show. I think we're up to, like, what, episode 16? And we may have to go back there because things are getting bad, folks. But I'll talk to Larry about that in the second hour. First hour, glad to have him back. I took a week off. He took a week off. Good God, seems like a forever ago that I talked to him on air. Michael Swanson, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com, be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. It's not just about Wall Street. I share tons of stuff from WallStreetWindow.com, articles by Charles Hugh Smith, J.G. Michael, the guy from Parallax Views. Mike Swanson writes some, too. And some of them are over there just under Wall Street Window staff and all that. Be in the know. Check that out. But also, he's the author of The War State, an essential reading book list thing that is out there. It's got a red cover on it. You can see Ike giving his farewell address, The War State, and I urge you to get a copy of it any which way you can. Recently saw there's an audiobook copy of it. I think I mentioned that on the show a few weeks ago. And the author of Why the Vietnam War, which is the first in a series on that particular subject. So, Mike Swanson, welcome back. How you doing, man?
Oh, I'm doing okay. How you doing?
Chaos is a thing. I've been in a bad mood. I've had a bit of stress. Past couple of days, Mrs. O was not home. I'm trying to take care of the hyper child, 5 dogs, and myself. And it's a little weirder than I thought it was. Anyway, who wants to hear about that?
When you were a kid, yeah. I think you mentioned, did you read comic books?
I wasn't a big reader of comic books because, quite frankly, the print is a little small. I got into a couple of them later. But as like a little kid, you know, when kids were reading like Superman and things like that, I saw these things. I saw other kids with them, but I didn't really have comic books. I kind of appreciated like the Batman TV show. And again, as I matured, my favorite and still remains to be my favorite is Punisher. But he was later, and he's a Marvel comic, and I stand by that still. It's one of the best storylines ever written. Even when they got Strange and resurrected him, and he was Franken? it doesn't matter. They went all sci-fi on it and everything and made him a futuristic warrior who was resurrected after he was killed. But in the initial storyline, Punisher's the greatest thing ever in comic books. But, you know, comic books, yeah, I want to talk about those. I also want to talk to you about the economy, Mike. I have to. I have no choice because I feel the hands of said economy around my throat on a daily basis. So, you know, between that and what other listeners are saying to me, we got to hit that subject, Mike. But comic books, yeah, let's go from there. Why do you bring up comic books, Mike?
Well, I didn't read a whole lot of comic books. I wasn't a comic book collector, so to speak. Hmm. But for 1 or 2 years, when I was like 11, I think it was, 10, 11, something like that, I lived in San Antonio. My dad was in the service. We moved around a lot.
Right.
And there was like a 7-Eleven a mile up the road.
Mm-hmm.
And I would walk to it frequently, you know, a bunch of kids, and I was buying comic books, and I was reading Mad Magazine, which is like a cultural satire magazine. Mm-hmm. It started in the 1950s, and
well, you know, I would pick those up every once in a while.
Okay.
The Mad Magazines. See, you said comic books, and I don't think of Mad Magazine as a comic book.
It's cartoons. It's got comics in
it. It's got comics in it, but it's mainly
not
like
a comic book, like you're saying.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just I was thinking about that magazine because I was listening to this other podcast called The Nostalgia Trap, actually. And they were talking about, not in the name, I mean, this was like a month ago, I think, but they do historical topics, and they were talking about some comic book that was before our time, and it was big in the 50s and in the 60s, and it was a pro-Cold War comic. And would you look, you know, they were talking about it, someone wrote a book about it, and I was looking at it, you know, images of it, and I should have thought about this before the show, but it's very sexualized type content, and you know, the soldiers are saving women about to be raped by Vietnamese and these sort of things, just all kinds of, this was like this, all kinds of crazy images, you know.
Right.
Anyway, and apparently these things were very popular and just died out, you know, towards the end of the Vietnam or towards the end of the 60s.
Well, sort of, but it had I know what you're talking about when it comes to those books, because there was a sort of a resurgence of it in comic books when I was a teenager. There was a series called The Nom, which was, you know, focused on this, and a lot of Cold War propaganda and pro-war propaganda in general had been interjected into everything. I mean, even the you know, the Warner Brothers and Looney Tunes cartoons used to do, you know, go buy war bonds and stuff, you know, during the Second World War. But in print books, these things were even more extreme. I mean, we all remember that Superman had a movie at one point that was about, you know, dealing with the nuclear issue, et cetera, et cetera. But there was kind of a resurgence after the sort of the Vietnam, some people call it the Vietnam guilt syndrome, started setting in the 80s. And along with the films that you and I have talked about, like the Rambos and the Missing in Actions and stuff like that, there were comic books that some of them more graphic than others that were meant to massage the history of that war in particular, but also to prop up all of the sort of Cold War stuff that was prevalent during the Reagan era, especially. So that's what we got to grow up with, but that stuff has been around a long time. So they're going through this on the Nostalgia Trap, it's called, and talking about what it was like in the 50s and 60s, where I guess that there was a higher resonance of what had, you know, just occurred, World War II, right? I mean, the history was fresh, but not super fresh. So they were starting to memorialize it in the art form, I guess. And some people would say that there's all kinds of symbols there, even like Stan Lee's work, where he comes out with, you know, the government fighting with the mutants and stuff like that. And that's about civil rights and also about people's positions on the war. It's actually a fascinating study to go through the cultural significance of comic books in general. But see, I was more about buying baseball cards probably when you were younger, and I was too. But yeah, I mean, and that's what I would buy. They were a quarter a pack. See, now I'm doing it costs a nickel to go to the movies. You know, they were a quarter a pack, and I was.
But
mad.
I did read that. Yeah. I did buy and read that Nine magazine because it the you know this was the same time. Right. You know, that, and that came out, I believe, before The Punisher. And
it did,
I was going to this store, that Nom was a new comic, you know, so I was buying it. I mean, I wasn't buying many comics, but I was buying that one, you know, maybe whatever. But I do remember, you know, I was just thinking about the Mad Magazine, is maybe that was something I was reading frequently, maybe that influenced me somehow or another, you know, the sarcasm and humor in it.
Well, yeah, a lot of goofy sarcasm, some political stuff in there, but also just making fun of, like, world leaders or, you know, pop culture stuff, making fun of it. You know, it's also the same era. See, now Mad Magazine pre-exists us. It was something that was out before we were born.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, we got our version of that might have been Garbage Pail Kids. Remember those?
Yeah, I remember them.
Okay,
no, this is all, go ahead. That was around the same time period where I was walking to this store.
Yeah,
you know? You
could buy those, yep.
Yeah.
I can't remember what Chuck's name was, but like every kid's name like had some kind of, you know, Nasty Nancy or whatever. I can't remember them all, but they were all pretty crazy, the Garbage Pail Kids. And there was a Chuck. I just can't remember what he was. Anyways, go ahead. I'm sorry. I just totally went off.
No, I'm going off tangents too. But that kind of, you know, what me worry Alfred P. Newman was, you know, an image in that magazine a whole lot, and that's, we're in a weird time now. You know, you have to have humor to deal with the madness that's going on, and you know, so that's things are starting to get to unravel in the financial markets.
Some of the silly things that might have been in Mad Magazine or The Onion a couple of years ago are now real. You got to double check the headlines always to see if it's a joke or if it actually happened. If you're me anyway. And one of the most unreal things here we go with the uncomfortable segue. One of the most unreal things to me is this exponentially increasing pressure on seemingly everybody who wants to point a finger. Okay, I'm going to point the finger at Joe Biden. I'm going to point the finger at the Ukraine war. I'm going to point the finger at the greedy corporations, which, by the way, I don't disagree with there, because corporate profits are doing just fine while the rest of us are scrambling to figure out how to pay for anything, Mike. You know, it's different in each region. It's different, obviously, you know, depending on what you buy in the grocery store. They're starting to acknowledge in the mainstream media that, oh, the grocery store thing is pretty harsh, especially talking about this recent issue with baby formula. Now they're like, oh, what about the grocery store? Yeah. What have I been saying the past, like, 2 years that this stuff has been creeping up? Now you noticed, huh? I guess your maid told you when she went shopping.
There is an inflation report that came out yesterday, the Consumer Price Index report. And the stock market has been falling, you know, since New Year's. And part of the reason is high inflation means higher interest rates, which hurts the stock market because it causes the costs for corporations to borrow money to go up, makes it so they make less money. And companies that have huge debts can go bankrupt from this situation too. So it makes the stock market get hurt. But because of that, people in the stock market, they want just like everybody, they want the inflation to stop really bad. I mean, everyone wants it to stop, but the stock market people on TV really want it to stop because they could be losing a lot of money in the stock market. So there are a lot of predictions that came out going into this consumer inflation report, that the report would show that inflation had peaked out or was starting to decline. And a lot of people were hoping that would be the case. And then the report came out and it was worse than expected.
Right.
And it showed that the inflation's at a 40-year high. And it went up to a new record since then again, officially 8.3% annualized.
Yeah, officially.
Yeah, so, and then the stock market dumped, you know, yesterday. So it's just tough, you know, and then.
Well, is it finally that the stock market is starting to reflect reality just a touch? Because for a long time there, as everybody's being squeezed, it seemed like, you know, you're what they used to call blue chip stocks, but I don't even know if that's a term anymore. It seemed like the main headliners there were doing just fine all the way along, and I guess that's great if you're invested in it, but truth is more people are watching it than actually participate. It's a very low number of Americans, let's just say, that own any of that stuff, and still they take it as a significant barometer, regardless of what it says versus the you know, on the ground reality. I take the grocery store again, where you're mentioning, you know, okay, now it's officially 8.whatever%, but not with the stuff I'm buying. It's way worse than that, and I'm not even in the worst area. By percentage, I'm in one of the worst areas where we're getting, you know, crushed at a faster rate. But honestly, there's much worse areas in the country that are taking it even harder. And that's not 8%. I would love 8% inflation if that was the reality across the board. It is not. You know, not with your energy bills, not with your gas, not with your, you know, not with your groceries, not with the things that you actually have to use on a daily basis. It's not. It just isn't. So I keep asking the question, you know, when is reality going to come to it? And I'm wondering if finally the stock market is having to deal with some of the reality that the rest of us are dealing with. I know that's a hostile sort of way to put it, Mike, but what are your thoughts?
Well, I make it a slightly different argument, okay. And that is that the stock market is slowly returning to reality.
Okay.
And that it got out of reality by going up so much in the past couple of years. And now it's falling because the heights of the valuations were so crazy. Let me give you an example, make it more concrete what I'm trying to say here. And I don't, you know, one thing about inflation, it makes it confusing to know whether the price you're paying for something is good or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure this is a good price. So is this a high price, $5.99 for a box of 8 sausages? That seems like a high price.
Mm-hmm. No, I just recently was looking at hamburger meat, honestly, and
okay.
I can tell you what the numbers were because I'm sitting there confused by that myself, where I said, well, this package is $15. Now, I know that last year or maybe a year and a half ago, it wasn't anywhere near that mark. I was wondering if $10 was okay a year ago. Or even at the beginning of this year, I was thinking for the same size package, it was 10. Now I'm looking at it going 15. And before I would have said, well, that's just overpriced in this particular store. Maybe I need to go somewhere else. But now I'm looking at it going, well, actually, am I going to find this any cheaper now somewhere else? And that's hamburger meat. And that's one of those things. And I go to another store, by the way, and found a similar price. And I forget the exact size. I could visually identify it, but I forget the exact size, but it was like, yeah, so that is half of what the cost was added on to the original cost. And that's about how it's going there with, you know, depending on how you want to evaluate that, you could say that it's 1/3 of the total price is the increase, or you could say that it's half of the original price that it's been increased by. So there's two pieces of confusion that you might be trying to do your math by. And that's something that I dealt with personally. And by the way, again, the $15 turns out wasn't so bad because I found it at $17 at another place.
Mm.
So I said, all right, well, you know, $15, I shouldn't have turned it down in the first place, I think. Needless to say, I'm not eating much hamburger meat here or feeding it to the house because it's too expensive. So that's where I'm at with it. I mean, there's an example I would give. Sausages could vary because of different levels of quality, and I do know that there's different levels of ground meat, sure, but I mean, sausage is a real serious variable because, I mean, your pedestrian kind of breakfast sausage is fairly cheap, but then again, you get a real, like a handmade kind of sausage, it could be different. But hamburger meat, you know, despite a little change in price based on the amount of fat content, right, how lean is it, changes the price and what quality is the cow. You know, you see Angus beef ground up, maybe it's more. But I mean, just regular standard, just we're not even going to tell you what kind of cow or anything. Just ground beef in general is up to that sort of percentage where I live. So that's what's happening. Also, in the chat room, somebody noted that the garbage pail kid for Chuck was up Chuck. And yeah, I now recall that. Thank you. Anyways, Mike, and I'm not trying to put upchuck and ground beef in the same sentence, but who knows, some people would probably agree with that. Anyway, that is the reality I see. So I'm not really all that, I mean, again, I see people looking at it as a barometer. It's a big report, but you're saying, okay, this is them coming back down to earth, sort of, right? Where,
well, I'm not the report, not that inflation report, the stocks.
The stock market reaction, right.
Is coming back to reality.
Okay.
So what happened was stocks went up so much. You know, when I started out, the stock market was the 1990s. And you go in a bookstore, Barnes & Noble, you buy all these books about how to pick out stocks. And one of the strategies that was real popular was to buy companies there are basically two strategies being promoted. One was to buy stocks that were so-called value stocks that, and this is what Warren Buffett promoted, and there's a book written in the 40s promoting this that he supposedly based his investing philosophy called, it's called Security Analysis, Benjamin Graham. Mm-hmm. But the idea was look for stocks that are actually cheap, and then you buy them, and then eventually they'll go up, and because you cheap, not just on price, but that the that if the company was bought out is worth more than the price you're paying. If it was just liquidated itself, you know, like say it's a real estate investment trust, a real estate company, well, the value of the properties is more than the value of the stock you're paying, you're buying. Mm-hmm. So that was one philosophy that no one talks about anymore, because the stocks, you know, you can't find stocks that are undervalued on a fundamental basis. So the other strategy, though, was to look for stocks that are growing earnings mm-hmm. at a fast rate. And then you can also look at how the valuations of those stocks are, the P/E ratios, price-to-sale ratios, all this, these sort of things. Well, over the past couple years, all that kind of analysis got thrown out the window because there's nothing, everything is so overvalued. Mm-hmm. So people started to look for concepts to invest in. So a year ago, we had AMC and GameStop, and the idea was, well, you don't, you know, GameStop might go bankrupt. It's the business isn't doing great, but there could be a short squeeze in the stock. Mm-hmm. So buy it on that idea. And the same thing, sort of similar with AMC. And then they shoot up and then they crash because it's not a long-term reason to invest in something. But so all these stocks started to appear where the companies don't make any profit and the valuations, you can't justify them. So they focus on a concept that's supposed to change the entire world. Crypto is a concept. It's right. Not... No, you know, you don't get a dividend. You don't get anything. It's just that this is going to change the world one day. They've been saying this for years, and it really hasn't changed anything. Mm. So to give an example, though, one stock that is an example, you know, kind of is a symbol of many stocks. There's a company that started trading a couple of years called Beyond Meat. Mm-hmm. And what they sell are sausages that are created from plant-based products.
Yeah, plant-based meat products is, yeah.
Yeah. I've never had one of these, but they sell them, and you six of I went to their website to look at the price. It's eight of their sausage patties are $5.99, six circular patties. Mm-hmm. Same price. It seems more expensive than what I pay, but regardless, this stock went up tremendously, and in the past couple months it's completely crashed. Mm-hmm. And when it came out, it was one that, you know, Zoom was a hot stock, Peloton in 2020, and this was one of those concept stocks that this was going to, you know, make it so. The promise was that this company would be so successful that this would be in everyone's grocery stores and everyone would just be, you know, buying this.
Well, see, now I have a question about uh-huh. this. I have a question about this because on the one hand, Peloton and Zoom and even the surge in the Netflix stock, right? Those things seem to be based on temporary effects that were occurring, right? Where it's like, look, people are going to be stuck on lockdown, so they might use the Peloton more. It seemed like that was a fair sort of logic. And Netflix might be part of that, but also might be part of this other thing where, look, this is going to change the reality of a certain business where, you know, and even with the artificial meat, right, the plant-based meat products, some might say, look, this is the future because it's more sustainable. There's a better economic value in not having to have a whole factory farm, you know, this kind of thing. And it's about the future. And if it becomes popular enough, right, then it'll be so valuable and still affordable. So it's like more forward thinking than just the temporary consequences of, say, like the lockdown with the Peloton. And really, I thought the food delivery services were going to do better. You and I talked about that on the show as it was happening. Didn't happen in the stock market, even though I thought it was a logical play. Apparently, there's a reason why I'm not in the stock market. But, I mean, you know, because I would have thought DoorDash and all these other things would have done well. Turns out the oversaturation in the market maybe didn't work out so well. And even though there are dominating businesses, you know, stock market play-wise, they're not exactly the best way to go. So there was that, and then there's the old standbys, it seems like to me. So what is the difference here, though, with the meat? Am I reading this right where, you know, the plant-based meat was more about, you know, hedging for the future as opposed to the temporary circumstance where somebody could make a short-term gain? Or do I have that all wrong, Mike?
It's always, even in 2020 with Zoom or Netflix, it's always the pitch is always the same. Okay. It's not just a temporary thing. It's that this is going to take over forever. Like, you know, with Zoom, for example, it's that back in 2020, they were saying, okay, Zoom's taking off. More and more people are getting on it because of COVID and shutdowns. Mm-hmm. But this isn't just a temporary deal. This is going to be permanent. Everyone's going to want to use Zoom. It's just going to be more convenient. People are going to not want to go to the office.
Okay. And, well, somebody must. Well, let me just ask this, though, because, again, I've got this in my head, and I could be wrong. Somebody must at some point pitch very temporary things, because, you know, just like the guy who's going to run for governor again in Georgia, who figured out it might be a good time to invest in the companies that make plastic gloves at the right time. Right. You know, stuff sure. like this, that's got to be temporary. Nobody's going to expect that the overwhelming demand for plastic gloves is going to be sustainable. Right. I mean, unless we're in the forever pandemic mode, which I don't think anybody ever realistically said was the case. So plastic gloves forever. And, you know, if you had hand sanitizer companies, you obviously made a fortune. You couldn't even keep up with demand. Somebody investing in those maybe temporarily would have thought that was a great thing, but hand sanitizer was going to go back to its, you know, pre-pandemic level at some point. So there had to be temporary pitches here too, or am I wrong about that? They pitch.
That argument makes sense. Okay. Those examples. What happened with the Beyond Meat thing, mm-hmm. though, the problem with all these situations is that whether it's temporary or it's something that's going to last for years or take over in 10 years, the promises typically fail to match the reality. So the Beyond Meat stock mm-hmm. has crashed. It's gone down like 90% mm-hmm. in a year. And they reported earnings just a few days ago, and despite the collapse in the stock, it has a market cap of $1.5 billion. So if you wanted to buy all the shares and take over the company, as Elon Musk is going to do with Twitter, mm-hmm. it costs like $35 billion, I think it was, for Twitter, or over that, somewhere around there. Well, this thing would cost $1.5 billion. That's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were to go and let's say there's a restaurant where you live, mm-hmm. a restaurant business, and the owner wants to sell it, it wouldn't cost $1.5 billion, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe it would cost a couple hundred thousand, maybe $1 million. Mm-hmm. I couldn't, you know, I'd say it's an Italian restaurant.
Well, it depends on where you are, and there's different elements that come into play, because you have different levels of traffic. You have a liquor license. I can tell you that even in the 1990s, you could sell any place that had a liquor license in certain places for $1 million. Starting bid would be about $1 million because of the liquor license. And there's equations that go into buying businesses like that. And so that's why it's so weird to me to see the Twitter thing.
I can tell you, I was involved in buying a couple businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And we paid, when you do that, when you buy a business, a restaurant, a mm-hmm. real world business, these were body shops, you typically look to pay 3 to 5 times earnings, profit.
For a year.
So if they're making, huh?
For 1 year, you pay 3 to 5 times 1 year's worth of profit, right?
Yeah, yeah. So if the restaurant is making $300,000 a year, $900,000 for the business,
right,
is what you pay. You might also include the property on top of that, or
well, that's a different evaluation when it comes to buying the business itself.
But yeah. Anyway, that's real world. Mm-hmm. And another example is rental properties. Typically, when an investor, a landlord, wants to buy a rental property, an apartment, so, or a house they're going to rent out, they look to pay 7 times what they collect from rent in 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more than a business. So, you know, example. But 7 times. 3 to 5 times for a business, 7 times for rental properties. So here's the thing. This Beyond Meat has a market cap of $1.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was one of the hottest stocks talked about on CNBC 2 years ago.
Right, and to take control of that $1.5 billion company, what you really got to do is invest $800 million, because that way you control the majority of the company, that's the end of it, and you're over the line on the half, right? I mean, that's the way to take over a company, right, and have...
Yeah, yeah.
You know...
Okay.
Okay.
Well, here's how much... It made it generated $109 million in revenue.
Mm.
That's revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned, according to this last earnings report, a gross profit off of that $109 million of revenue. $109 million. Mm-hmm. It turned a gross profit of $190,000.
Wow. Wow. I mean, that's worse than any restaurant margin I've ever heard in my life. And restaurant margins are slim. I mean, it's bad. Even when you're having to throw out lobsters, okay, because they go bad on you. Yeah, it's never that bad. Wow. That's horrible. That's... So that means, literally speaking...
Insane. When I was in high school, I worked at a Walmart. And they were... Back then, the Walmart closed at 9 o'clock, and we'd have to clean up the store. And they would get the store manager would say on the intercom how much revenue the store generated in that day, and it would go from like 70,000 to 150,000, depending on the day of week, you know, day, time of year. And so that one Walmart store. And I know I would have to do sometimes changing the prices, look on the computer. They generally were doing a 50% markup on all the items in the store.
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah, mostly. So, you know, that one store would have, you know, generated several million dollars in profit a year. Might be over 10. So that one store generated more than this Beyond Meat company did in profit.
Well, here's the scary
thing. It's
crazy. Well, here's the scary thing, Mike. Scary thing. If that was a real world business, right? What did you say that their gross profit was? Their profit was 109%.
One. It's basically a dollar. They're making a dollar a profit off every $100 in revenue.
Yeah, but this is how warped this is. Because look, if you've got $109,000, right, and I were to walk in there, and if you have a business that's generating that annually, and I said, look, I've got $1 million offer, you're taking it, because I've just offered you 9 times what it is at $109,000. I've offered you 9 times your annual profit, okay? And this is what you can show. That's fine, and you'll probably take it if you're looking to sell that business. Doesn't matter about the other numbers, but here's the thing. You're telling me that according to the stock market, though, it has, and that's a generous offer on a $109,000 generator at $1 million, with no property or anything else added in.
Yeah.
Fact is, okay, 9 times, and meanwhile, the market has it valued at over 800 times. that. Because in order to leverage more than half of the market value, you need $800 million, as I just said.
Yeah.
So it takes... That's insane.
It's totally crazy. Here's the thing about it. The stock is at... It's $25.
Okay.
And a year ago, it got up to $200. So it was even eight times 1.5. It was over $10 billion, worth over $10 billion. So it's crashed, but it's still worth $1.5 billion, and it's around $25. There's no reason to stock. It's really worth $1 or $2.
Right.
You know, and this thing was around $200. This is why the stock market's going down, because there's so many stocks and situations like this inside of it, and it just got crazy. You know, when they made interest rates zero, and did all this stuff after it was already overvalued, and then they made the interest rates go to zero and made it get even more overvalued.
Oh man.
It's just, and that interest rate policy is what's helped to drive all this inflation. So it's just a complete mess.
Well, but see, that's the thing. Is it helping to drive the inflation, the overvalued stock market, or is it just, you know, again, the veil coming down on the con game? Because quite honestly, it seems like everything is overvalued. Everything is overvalued except the money in your pocket. That's what it comes down to here. I mean, I'm looking at prices. You had an article that you shared as part of your emails, and I put it out as a joke for a minute because it was about Big Pizza is being affected by the economy. And what Big Pizza is all these corporate, you know, crap, garbage pizza places like Papa John's and, you know, Domino's and places like Pizza Hut, whatever. These corporate pizza joints... They can't make any money, they're saying, right, because of the way the economy is forcing them to raise their prices. Now, you try and go, and if you and I opened a pizza shop, Mike, I don't even want to think about what I'd have to charge for a pizza if I was to put anything resembling real quality ingredients in it. But these people with their frozen garbage are selling it across the country and still turning a decent profit, but now they're complaining because... their profits being cut into, because who the hell can afford a damn pizza? I mean, there's a lot of people that would be eating that all the time that now can't afford it, not even Domino's. And quite honestly, I can't afford the diarrhea, so I don't eat Domino's, okay? But it's horrible stuff. All that stuff is terrible. I mean, there's a couple of them.
Domino's when I was a teenager.
Yeah, but, you know, listen, I could look at the women I dated as a teenager and know that my mind was not in the right place at that time. I mean, you definitely have brain issues as a teenager. I mean, not just you, Mike. I'm not being personal, but we all make bad decisions as teenagers. So Domino's Pizza's yours, and I could give you a long list of mine. But, I mean, the stuff's awful. It's absolutely awful. They're complaining about their awful stuff. I mean, Domino's at one point even had to take pizza off of their damn signs. Because, quite frankly, it's not. Anyway, it's a disc. It allegedly has tomato sauce in it. It allegedly has cheese on it. I would not put my faith in any of that, nor would I call it pizza. But anyhow, they're complaining because their profit margins are getting cut into because of inflation. Right? I mean, and they're also complaining because the delivery apps, which add on, you know, extra money to try and pay people to run food around, they're adding on money to this and everything else. But these people wanted to save money by not running their own delivery services, which becomes a complicated thing. And meanwhile, they're delivering you garbage. So, you know what? I'm not crying for Big Pizza at this point. But I'm thinking to myself that this is a great metaphor for a lot of the crap that has been sold in our country for quite a long time. And now people are looking at it and they can't afford it. And they're starting to maybe realize that they've always overpaid for this stuff. Okay. But now it's just exponentially increasing constantly. So, you know, I don't even know when the last time I actually ordered a pizza was. I can't afford it. an actual pizza, not even just one of the, I mean, even if I wanted to try and order one of these corporate ones, I mean, I guess I could, but, you know, I'd hate myself a couple hours later, probably. All of it gives me indigestion. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. You guys tell me. But it's just that it's a perfect metaphor for what's going on in this country. You know, they cut the quality, they cut the service, they cut everything, and now you're being charged more for it. And, you know, welcome to America. That's the way it is. I don't know. And meanwhile, the stock market, most of us not even participating in it, really. Most of us not being affected by it directly. I mean, it doesn't change your minimum wage at Amazon when Amazon's stock goes up or down, does it? I don't think it does. You know, even when they're making $1 trillion or when the place that you work at sells iPhones, which have a huge, you know, a huge amount of profit for the amount of actual physical materials that are in them.
Yeah.
You know, well, I mean, Doug
complained about the pizza. Have you ever heard of the literal combat ship?
Little combat ship? No, go ahead.
Literal, L-I-T-T-O-R-A-L.
Apparently
I'm
not.
Probably not pronounced.
No, it's okay.
I'm just, our friend J.P. Satilli is tweeting about it.
Oh, God.
I recognize the name and the look of the boat, but it was the main naval program a couple years ago. They're little cruisers and anti-submarine boats.
Okay.
Like little pocket cruisers.
Okay.
But the Navy's scrapping them. And what I didn't know is how much they cost. It's crazy. And they're scrapping them because they're evidently aren't very good ships.
Mm-hmm.
And the sailors called them little crappy ships. That's the nickname for them. Because
mm-hmm.
I guess it's like the problem I'm having, probably. It's hard to pronounce. Literal, you know, it's hard to pronounce it.
No, I but understand.
But what's happening, mm-hmm. one of the things happening as a result of this story, though, is that this is being used as a talking point of the failure of the Biden administration. Because by scrapping this program,
mm-hmm.
By sheer numbers, they're projecting that the Chinese naval fleet will have more boats than the U.S. naval fleet. And this means, you know, a complete defeat, I guess, for us.
Right. Well, see, now, does anybody take a quality scale to any of this? Because, again, if you're getting rid of things that don't work right, and you're simply saying, well, we're losing the numbers there, you're also losing things that are inept. I mean, and I don't know if I would blame the Biden administration for this. Just like that ship that's docked not too far from you with sailors on it claiming there's constant construction, they're freaking out, there's a whole bunch of suicides.
Well, there have been suicides.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and it's because of their horrible living conditions. I don't mean to laugh, but, you know, that's not something that started when Biden took office. There's a whole mess of stuff going on here where, you know, even though we're sinking the most money on the planet into the military, corners are still being cut like it's any corporate institution. I mean, what are we doing here? Scrapping these things? I don't know. I don't know enough of the details to tell you that it's a good idea, bad idea, but I can tell you that the military is famously involved in this kind of stuff all the time. And the Navy seems to be one of the most difficult to maintain things. And clearly, nobody seems to know how to manage it properly. Because I've heard these stories my whole life about, yeah, you wouldn't believe it, even though they put a whole lot of money into this and that, this is what you get.
Well, I'm quickly looking at the history of this program.
Mm-hmm.
It was proposed in the 90s.
Right.
And at first it was going to cost $90 million to build a boat. It was going to be a 1,000-ton, specialized, small, you know, for in comparison to other boats, $90 million boat. And small, light, fast. 2001 came around.
Right.
And they committed $15 billion, the Navy did, mm-hmm. for the program. And then it turned out the cost to build these boats went up,
right,
from $90 million to $220 million, because it was decided that they wanted to fit a helicopter on them and be able to achieve a minimum 40 knots speed in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And the budget, more budget overruns happened. I don't think these things have ever been in combat.
Well, probably not. See, that's the other thing is that, you know, let's take it away from the Navy for a second. Those armored personnel carriers that they've had the various types of, right? A lot of those ended up getting what? Donated pretty much to local police forces all over the country because they had too many of them, right? They were excess equipment basically given by the Pentagon, giving them away to municipalities. I mean, I've seen these things myself, Bearcats and all this stuff. And you're like, well, why are we running this stuff off the line? And why are we paying for this? And those pieces of equipment, to my knowledge, work well. But the problem is you got an overabundance of money being thrown at this situation as opposed to somebody intelligently spending. I mean, and I'm not even all for this massive military, obviously. But, I mean, if you're going to do it, how about do it efficiently and put the money in the right place? So this is yet another one of these boondoggles here, but this one brought to you by the Navy, right? Where they've got a ship, they don't have a real purpose for it, but keep building it anyway. And, oh, well, it didn't quite fit with the War on Terror plans. You know, I mean, helicopters did. I'm sure helicopter manufacturers don't have a huge excess.
This is really crazy.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
So they did a report in 2012 about problems. This is a Navy report, too. And it concluded that this ship is ill-suited for combat operations against anything but, quote, small boats not armed of anti-ship weapons.
Mm.
It's whatever, you know. I don't know what kind of boats those would be. Fishing boats? I don't know. But anyway, they said, so they had to revise the plans on how to use these things. If they can't use them, if they can't be used against other boats that are armed,
mm-hmm.
then how do you use them?
Right.
So they incorporate them into a war game against China, in which they would play the role of being kind of like lookout ships,
okay,
ahead of the fleet, that if they came under
But didn't we already have,
if
I mean,
they came
maybe
under attack, they would just turn around and retreat.
You know, maybe I should ask Doug Horn, because he was in the military, you know, dealing with transportation. I should ask him about this, but could have swore we already had scout ships before they started building these things. And, you know, we could have just, I don't know, used the same design and kept with them if they were efficient. But no, now they're trying to find a use for these. That's the backwards logic that goes into these huge programs that nobody really challenges, by the way, not your left or your right, ever challenges this stuff. They pretty much, I mean, they give the Pentagon more money than they ever ask for, you know, most years, okay? And it doesn't matter, the Democrats don't want to fund the military. Yes, they do. They do it all the time. Everybody does. Everybody's in on that. Oh, can't take money out of the Pentagon budget. And nobody ever even looks at this kind of stuff until long after it's already a giant black hole of waste. I mean, Mike, I don't know, man.
It's pretty humorous.
It's humorous, but only in a very dark, sort of sardonic, ironic way. Because
Well, that's where I get back to that. Yeah. That's, you know, it's like reading Mad Magazine.
Right.
So, in 2013, that was a plan as a way to use it against China in the Pacific theater. They don't use the word China, but that's what they mean. And then they scrapped that idea. Hmm. And in 2014, they came up with the idea: you can't use this in the Pacific, but you could use it in the Persian Gulf.
Okay.
And then after that, the next year, 2014, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, so this is all during the Obama administration, he asked the Navy to just come up with a new boat. And I guess, you know, I don't know what the new boat is after this one, but
Oh, whatever. You know, according to Trump, Obama wouldn't fund the military, right? Seems like there was plenty of funds for crap like this when Obama was in there. Maybe it's just me. You know, and what is the answer to throwing money at things like this that go down the tubes? Let's throw more money at it. I always got to shake my head. Whenever you start to dig into any of this stuff, you know, you start reading about some of the... I was going through, I remember the whole thing with you about the military programs that were there that they were spending, you know, millions of dollars on that really were not military programs. They were sort of like cultural programs. And it makes no sense to me to do that either. Like, look, I understand music appreciation and all that good stuff, but I don't need the military to fund it. Let the military fund the military. I mean, it's just, it's very weird. Remember all that? It was like millions of dollars for these guys to have different bands in the military. And it's like they don't actually serve a purpose. It's not even like just the color guard who shows up and, you know, does funerals and all that, which, by the way, that's another cost. But, I mean... It is so bizarre to me to watch. Anytime you start to peel the onion of the military budget, you can always find this stuff, but nobody ever really checking into it. Everybody just kind of rubber stamping it. And then years later, we find out, well, we got all this excess equipment. I don't know if it's a good idea or a bad idea to scrap this thing either, still. Don't know all the details, but if you're trying to find a purpose for a giant fleet of things you created, you might want to consider whether you should have created the giant fleet of things in the first place. I don't know. Maybe that's just common knowledge.
They built a total of 35 of them.
Okay. How many billions of dollars for 35 of these things?
It was a lot. 3.2 billion. Okay.
And they're not nuclear subs. Because that was another thing you and I talked about, is the nuclear subs.
The story that, you know, got me down this rabbit hole was today that they're scrapping them all. They're just scrapping them. And it says that by scrapping them, you know, they won't have to maintain them, and that's going to free up $400 million that they're going to use for additional spending for what, I don't know.
I don't know, the F something, the FU whatever plane that's coming next, right? I don't know, Mike. I know we went into a couple different directions here, and we're coming down to the last few minutes, so I'm just going to shut
but
up and
there's
let
a
you
tweet
try it up.
That Senator Jim Inhofe,
oh boy,
did a presentation.
Yep.
In which he's the one, he did a presentation about projecting that the Chinese Navy is going to get to 460 ships. And the U.S. Navy is now going to decline. It was going to go to 347 ships.
Right.
But now, this is a very misleading chart, but his chart now says U.S. Navy flat budget and shows the numbers, shows a decline in ships. But I don't think the budget's actually flat.
This is hilarious.
Correct.
In the chat room, News Guy dropped an article, which is... titled "The Littoral Combat Ship's Latest Problems," or latest problem, excuse me, class-wide structural defects leading to hull cracks. So what you're telling me is that you got these ships that nobody knows what to do with, that the hulls are cracking, and they're saying, let's just scrap it, scrap the program, scrap them, and other people are complaining the Chinese are going to outnumber us. Well, you know, okay.
Well, why can't we just... You know, do what,
gentlemen, you can't fight in here. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is a war room. I mean, what are we talking about, Mike?
Well, why can't we just do what General Eisenhower did before the Normandy invasion? He fooled the German intelligence by putting patents somewhere in England, and then having these rubber boats out there to make them think that was a real fleet that might, you know, come and invade somewhere in France that wasn't Normandy. So why can't we just, instead of making these, you know, billion-dollar boat programs to have more boats than China, why not just get some really cheap boats? This one didn't work very well. It has hull problems. So why can't we just get some, you know... canoes or something. I don't know.
Canoes. I almost said that, and I thought that's just too silly, but I'm glad you said it. let's get some iron, you know, Ironside type, I don't know, flotation devices out there and see if we can steer those. I mean, as long as the numbers are greater. My head hurts, Mike. I'm sorry. Meanwhile, I'm going to include the link to this article that was dropped in the chat room and any links Mike wants to give me for this part of the discussion. But, Michael, what is your takeaway? What is the grand lesson here that we should get from the littoral fleet that is not really working out and apparently has cracked holes, nobody knows what to do with them, and billions of dollars invested from many different administrations? See, again, it's sort of like Afghanistan. Biden's going to take the blame, but he didn't start it. Oh, everybody forgets that. But, okay. And I blame them all, by the way. Biden should get equal billing with these people. But is it the reality that we're supposed to complain about the current administration trying to deal with the mistakes of the past? I don't know. Mike Swanson, last couple of minutes is all yours, and let's wrap it up. And I'm entertained, but I don't want to be this way. I got to say... And, you know, as per usual, go to WallStreetWindow.com, be in the know. Mike, you going to put out some articles about this in the next few days, too? A few more, maybe?
Well, actually, I'm looking at one right now, and there's actually a lot of opposition to them scrapping the boats.
Right. Of course
from congressmen. They don't want to scrap them. They want to keep them going. I mean, I already told you Inhofe's argument, but... I mean, I don't know what the I'm sure there's jobs to service these boats too. They don't want to get rid of those jobs.
Oh, look, there's jobs to service them. There's jobs to build them. There's jobs to create spare parts. I mean, you know, there's jobs connected to this because it is the military industrial complex. So, again, Mike, go ahead and clear us out here.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it's one, I mean, there's so many rabbit holes you can fall down. That was the one we did today. But meanwhile, as you're saying, the cost of everything that you go to the store and buy is going up. So hopefully they can fix these problems or scrap them before the cost of the boats go up again. They've already gone up multiple times.
Well, and why wouldn't they, just like everything else? Because after all, we are in the grand inflationary curve, I guess. And, yeah, let's inflate all that, too, and let's keep conflating the situation, because, after all, we need boats that'll crack, because we got to outnumber China. Mike Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com, the author of The War State, the author of Why the Vietnam War, and glad you're back, Mike. It's fun to talk to you, but, man, how weird is the world, right?
Oh, it's crazy.
Anyway, stick around. In the next hour, Larry Hancock will be with me, and maybe we'll complain about something else on the Ocelli Effect. We'll be right back.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Support Chuck Ocelli at Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so...
Yeah, that is
the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And, you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model, too. And, look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain. Okay, because people want to support you. They love you to death, but honestly...
So if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show. And I want you to do this, too, because... you know, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, you know, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
In denial. Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect continues now at ocelli.com. But, of course, you could be listening some other time, some other place, some other way. And no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, we do appreciate you. So, thankfully, I have my regular rotation should be back up and running, except Mike Swanson won't be with us next week. And Larry Hancock has returned. Now, 1 week I was not feeling so good. 1 week Larry had another obligation and was going to try and squeeze us in, but I said no. Larry, by all means, you've done enough shows with me and everything. Don't even force it. Let's get you back when something needs to be addressed. And frankly, I was getting tired of talking to Larry about Ukraine. We might touch on that today, but maybe not. Because, what happened is, a well-meaning podcaster sent me a guest suggestion. And I don't want to name names or make anybody look bad or anything, but, he sent it to me in good faith and said, this guy is a JFK researcher. He's written a book. He does a good presentation. You ought to check him out. I said, okay. And so I took a listen to the show that the guy has at the top of his own website. And within about 15 minutes, I said, oh, boy. This is almost everything that I can't stand in JFK research circles in like one bucket, if you will. And I sent it to Larry Hancock, the author of a great many books on the subject, also a great many books in general describing the behaviors and the intricacies of the national security state from one angle or another. I mean, we could name them all if we wanted to, but then I might run out of time on the podcast segment here because Larry's written a whole bunch of them. Someone Would Have Talked. There's a great one. Of course, Unidentified. Yes, indeed, that's about UFOs, but national security state thing, and Larry's involved in a project there on that front, last I checked. A lot of different things. Surprise Attack, Shadow Warfare, The Awful Grace of God, co-authored with Stu Wexler. I mean, look, Larry's written a lot of great stuff. I mean, Creating Chaos, one of my favorites, by the way. But tonight we're going to go back into the JFK topic just a bit. And unfortunately, what we're going to have to talk about is the lack of discernment. The thing that I have to confront every single time somebody asks me to speak about this, answer questions about it, a whole lot of nonsense cobbled together into people's podcasts. And some of them, look, they don't claim to be doing research. They just claim to be observing things, and I get it. But when they invite an expert on and they've not vetted their information, they don't know about the case, I guess it's easy to fall prey to people sort of creating an amalgamation. I guess that would be a good word. A nexus of nonsense. Oh, there's another book title, Larry Hancock, Nexus. But his isn't about nonsense. But that's what I was observing. Anyway, before I say anything else, Larry Hancock, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing good, Chuck. I'm happy to be back.
I almost feel like we have to resurrect the JFK Myths subseries on the show just for this one presentation that I shared with you. And really, I wanted you to look at it and see. You and I are a little different. We definitely have come at things from a different angle. You're a good writer. I am not. You are a great mind when it comes to the history and the context of things. And, Well, I've got my perspective, but, you know, I don't consider myself part of the, you know, the intelligence of the study of intelligence as much as somebody like you is. So I said, well, maybe I'm not seeing the bigger picture here with this presentation. And I've seen this before, but, I mean, the exemplar of what's wrong with people going, well, because of this, and because I saw a picture, and because somebody else said this, and I have this piece of hearsay that I got from somebody else's book, and they stitch these things together. Now, this is not even uncommon in JFK land, is it, Larry?
No, it's not. And I have some sympathy, because it's easy to fall into, I mean, the common word these days is silos. Like, you fall into this thing, you get interested in it, and you dig deeper, and you see everything vertically. It's kind of like, you know, I've got a starting point. I'm going to look at everything that matches this, and I'm just going to dig. And with the extreme amount of content on the internet, especially if you use that as your main source, which is tempting because it's quick, you know, and you get instant gratification, you start connecting names and that sort of thing, and you know, you get excited. And I have to say, over the years, I've been in, you know, we talked about this, Chuck. I wrote a manuscript about, you know, LBJ and Malcolm Wallace. And then after 5 years, I ditched it because it didn't prove in. I started out looking at the mob did it scenario and spent 4 or 5 years on that. And, you know, so it's easy. I think easier today because there's so much on the internet. If you just kind of feed off, you know, a Facebook post and YouTube videos, you can do that more quickly than I was doing it. But the problem is it gets to be a trap, because you're following your own path. You know, you're seeing, you're pulling in what you want to pull in, and there's no, you know, there's nothing like peer review or sanity checks, and you just get excited. So I can have some sympathy for it, because I've gone into three or four silos and only come out after a few years myself.
Right, and I can too, because look, I've even seen well-meaning people who are trying to study just a small aspect of the case misled. I'll give you a weird example. There is a mortician who has a fairly popular YouTube channel that decided to take on the Kennedy autopsy, right, as part of these presentations about educating people. You know, this is what coroners do, this is what morticians do, this kind of stuff, and fairly solid information all the way up until she gets to the Kennedy assassination, where she makes a complete mess of her descriptions, because I can tell where her sources were. And I go, oh man, this is somebody who actually has expertise in a field, who's trying to explain something, and she doesn't even recognize the two groups of morticians handling the body to begin with, you know, the day of the assassination, right? Within 24 hours, you've got two distinctively different funeral homes that get involved with the body. And she doesn't have that laid out. She doesn't have the sequence of events laid out even remotely clearly, as to what happened, when the autopsy was conducted, and actually claims that an autopsy was conducted in Dallas at one point. And I go, wow, where did you even get that from? I don't know. Because you and I both know that I don't think anybody would state that an autopsy was conducted in Dallas that we know. I mean, have you ever heard that before?
The only thing, I'm wondering if she's feeding off David Lifton's concept that there was work done on the head. I don't think David would call it an autopsy.
No, he would call it an exploratory
or something like that done either in Dallas or on the way to D.C. I mean, that's the only thing I could think of that she could even pull in at all.
Well, key factor there is that he called the body the best evidence, which is the title of his book, which, you know, is a fair enough supposition. And he states in his book many different ways that surgery had to have been conducted on the body before the official autopsy was conducted. Which, look, we could argue about the minutiae of that. We could discuss it, or we could talk about the validity of it. But under no circumstances does he ever claim that a proper autopsy was done okay, previous to the improper autopsy that we all know about at Bethesda. So I'm saying to myself, this is a key foundational problem with your presentation. You're saying that an autopsy was conducted when I've never seen that stated. Anybody tried to accuse anybody of conducting an autopsy previous to the one we all know about. Now, if she said that the body might have been altered or there is a theory that the body was altered, I would say fair enough, good. But stating that there was an autopsy ahead of this, I go, no. I just
and especially
no.
Especially without stating a source. I mean, you can't... One of the things that you don't find in most of the interviews and podcasts, and I guess there's a reason for it, is you get many statements that are made without a source. And in the one that you and I both looked at recently, I mean, one of the major propositions of the scenario being presented was that A, David Ferry had been a U-2 pilot for the CIA, and David Ferry was actually commanding the operation in Dealey Plaza for the CIA.
Yeah, and may have been a shooter.
Just stated outright. Now, it's like, okay, you need a lot of backstory if you're going to make a statement like that. You just can't say it, you know?
Well, how are you going to put him there? Who says he was there? Do you have any documentary evidence that he was in Dallas exactly at that moment? Do you have, okay, now some people go, well, what about the photographs? And you go, oh boy, because this guy also brings in photographs into his discussion and starts telling us that he sees people in photographs that I know he's misidentifying. I mean, like we've been over this already. Okay, I mean, even well, the...
And yeah. With Ferry, you have the little problem of he's actually on record as having been in a courtroom in New Orleans at the Marcello hearing at the time of the shooting. So unless you're going to offer a proposition that this is a body double, which is a strange thing in itself, and a body double for David Ferry is even stranger, it's sort of like, wait a minute, there's... I think one of the traps, and I think that everybody that explores this has to, you know, condition themselves to avoid is you can't start making your own mysteries. You know, if everything, it's like I've got this scenario that I'm following, and you know, the official evidence and official storylines and things that are inner evidence contradict it. But I'm just going to reject that and so say that those are all bogus. I mean, not that there aren't a few bogus things around you have to deal with, but if you start doing that too much, then you've really made your own myth. I mean, you just can't throw away everything associated and say, oh, well, all of that was made up, but trust me, my story's true.
Well, yeah, taking the David Ferry story just a little further, just that aspect, which, by the way, is not even the cornerstone of this guy's presentation, okay, in my mind. David Ferry, well, you know what? He didn't actually have alopecia either, right? David Ferry, according to this guy, lost his hair because he was flying the U-2 planes. Okay. So I have questions. First of all, how do we verify that? Secondly, where are you getting that he was flying U-2? Planes. When was he a U-2 pilot? I mean, I get that he was a pilot. I get that the CIA may have been aware of him. I get that you could say that maybe he was useful in some way or other. But how do you actually get to saying this guy was a U-2 pilot?
When we do have very solid historical data from the Air Force and from the CIA, it's like the history by this point in time. You know, like 40 years ago, maybe the U-2 was mysterious.
Okay.
Now, there are multiple excellent books that discuss each and every flight, who the pilot was, where, you know, down to the level of what intercepts were done of the Russians tracking the flights, you know, what NSA was collecting, intercept. We know all that. So, again, I think one of the risks, if we're talking about risk, if you just start mining YouTube and Facebook for data, you run a real risk of integrating stuff that's 30 years old, or, you know, all those old mysteries that have been resolved. And if you bring them forth and present them, you're just making yourself look bad, because mm-hmm. you don't know that that's already been resolved. And we know so much about the U2, I think it's fairly safe to say. Plus, the other thing we know is from Ferry's own court appearance records and experiences with the airlines that he flew with, we know his flight records too. You know, so right. none of these things are really mysterious anymore. However, if you drop into certain parts of the internet, they might appear to be if right. it's your first exposure.
Well, and that's the thing. Look, Ferry's an interesting character all the way around. I mean, even the connection with the Civil Air Patrol, all that weirdness, and people that have been interviewed about that and given their side of the story regarding this. I mean, the guy is clearly let's call him an atypical character. All right. But I mean, this weirdness of his alopecia begins because of the U2 flights, when you don't have any sort of evidence. I mean, look, if you can show me evidence that the guy actually participated in U2 flights, I'd love to see it, you know, but best I know, there is none. And then trying to put him in Dealey Plaza, which, of course, you have the logistical problem of where he is on record as being. Okay. But also, I have you ever seen a photograph that even remotely looks like David Ferry in Dealey Plaza? In all the, by the way, there are hundreds of photographs of, you know, a short period of time in Dealey Plaza. I mean, still or film. I once saw something, I think it was produced in England, where somebody did some computer morphing weird thing and tried to put David Ferry in there. But it was like almost based on like a shadow on the retaining wall. Was such a weird... I think I saw that years ago as a joke to put David Ferry in there.
There have been a couple done like that along the lines of, you know, we could put anybody in Dealey Plaza. Here, look, we can find... If you work at it a little bit, you can find somebody that looks like anybody and put him in Dealey Plaza. But I think just, again, with sanity testing, let's talk about people that have been brought up as shooters in Dealey Plaza. And even the most basic sanity test says, well, if I'm going to send someone to Dealey Plaza to take a shot at the president, you know, I should be able to offer you some proof that they're a marksman. I mean, what we complain all the time that Lee Oswald is put forth as, you know, a sharpshooter when he wasn't, and he's not a marksman. So turn it around the other direction, and so we should be able to ask the question of, like, well, okay, if you have David Ferry as a shooter, give me some proof that he was a marksman. If you have Sergio or Kasia Smith or Johnny Roselli as show me they know how to use a rifle and they practiced a rifle. There's got to be some credence to using them, not just as an interesting person, a person of interest, but if you're going to name them as a shooter at the President of the United States, I mean, because anybody putting this together would have to be sane enough to pick people that have some credentials as marksmen. Show me that backstory. And you can't do it. David Ferry, or Sergio Smith, or even Johnny Roselli.
Well, see, here's the thing. Roselli, to the best of what I could uncover, might have been adequate with a handgun.
Right.
You know, but no evidence that I've ever seen shows that he had any proficiency with a long gun of any kind. That's Roselli. Now, you go to Oswald, and look, I would even argue that there are contradictory accounts and records that would say that Oswald was not like a complete disaster with a rifle in his hand that some people say he was. I think he might have been an adequate shot. Adequate. Not, you know, skilled marksman or anything like that. I think he might have actually been decent with a decent weapon.
I would agree, Chuck, and I would say he would be closer to being adequate than any of the three people I just named, and he would have used a weapon more recently.
Yeah.
Than any of those three people. And there's a case. I mean, we know that he hunted. with his family in Texas. He hunted when he was in Russia. I mean, he's at least comfortable with carrying a weapon. You take Sergio Arcacha Smith, who was a politician in Cuba, came out, became a political figure early on among the anti-Castro Cubans, and then was an air conditioner salesman in 1963. Right. You know, I'd be forced to, if I were making a list, I would be forced to put Lee Oswald above all those folks.
Well, right. And the thing is, look, a shotgun in Russia, which he was allowed to have, which he allegedly used to hunt. Again, rifles might have been used in his earlier life. He was trained. Okay. Every Marine gets trained with a rifle. He was a Marine. Okay. So he was trained with a rifle. And, you know, look, you got examples. They kept track of his records. If you look at them, some people would say, oh, those are altered or what. Okay, fine. But what I'm saying is what I have in my hand is enough to say that there's enough fragmentary evidence here to say that he might have been familiar with weapons. Now, Sergio Arcacha Smith, that was another surprise in this presentation, by the way. What roof did they put him on? I forget now. It got a little confusing because
I got the impression that it was a little confusing. It was either the school book depository or the Deltex, and they had him climbing down from the roof.
Okay.
Now, both of those roofs have parapets on them, and Sergio was kind of like fairly heavy individual, and you know, late 40s, early 50s. You just don't picture him kind of climbing down several stories off a roof and making an escape. He was on the roof somewhere.
Okay, but by the time you add up all these shooters, and this is where, by the way, it almost sounded very familiar to me, and I'll tell you why. It sounded very much like, look, I'm going to name this name. Jim Fetzer. If you let him go long enough, which I tried to for a couple of minutes a few years ago, where it was like, well, tell me about your shooting scenario. I mean, the guy's got shooters everywhere. There are guys with weapons everywhere. I mean, all different angles. It is, and it sounded like this guy picked up Fetzer's shooting solution and tried to run with it. Because he's got shooters on top of like all the roofs. He's got them, you know, on the knoll, of course. There's at least one on the knoll. There's one on the other side of the street. There's guys on the railroad bridge, under the railroad bridge. I mean, I don't know if I, in the blur, I missed maybe one in the sewer somewhere because I was waiting on that. Everywhere. He's got...
I came up with 6 to 8 on my count, but I think I got lost too. But again... The funny thing is, if you get really specific and you name all of these people, to some extent you've named A. It makes no sense. I mean, how did they all get away? What fluke lets 8 people, and who would plan to have 8 people get away? All of whom are connected to known people. I mean, several of them are mob. If a single one of them gets picked up, you just blew apart your whole conspiracy. None of them are deniable. You know, they're all connected to somebody or somewhere, and the investigation would be swift. And it's hard to see how anybody in their right mind would do that. That's kind of like putting Johnny Roselli in the sewer. If poor John gets stuck, or John gets picked up, you know, whoever is behind this is immediately blown because everybody in law enforcement knows who John Roselli is, like several of these people. Mm-hmm. So there's even a basic sanity testing going on here. Does it really make sense? Can you see anybody doing this and thinking, and they got away with it, right? Because all of those people managed to just wander off and get away. Nobody got caught.
Right. And it is the buffet, by the way, of conspiracy theories, because he's got mob guys. He's got agency guys. He's got anti-Castro Cubans. He's got cops. Okay. All involved. One of the weirdest ones, though, a go-to with these guys is Lauren Hall, right? I'm pretty sure that in this scenario, Lauren Hall is in the sniper's nest.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay,
yeah.
So Lauren Hall's in the sniper's nest, and still nobody's going to explain to me how it is somebody escaped, okay, from the sixth floor. Especially
there's two guys on the sixth floor.
Yeah, two guys there, yeah.
But I thought Jack Valenti was kind of...
That's where I was going next.
CIA assassin was pretty radical. But again...
Well, yeah, hang on, wait. Don't move. Don't move on that. Because, Larry, tell me something. Just for the uninitiated listener, who is Jack Valenti? Please.
You really want me to? Okay.
Tell people
who
that is.
First of all, Jack Valenti. Let's. Jack Valenti was as well known in entertainment circles in Washington D.C. I mean, he's a well-known figure. He's all over the place. Jack Valenti is.
Yeah.
Is. I'm trying to figure out the best way to describe him. He's kind of like Roselli in a way.
Listen, I'm trying not to laugh while you do it. So please, by all means, move forward. It's just, it's so funny to me. In my chat room immediately, somebody goes, the MPAA guy?
Yeah. It's just if you're reaching out for name. Here's, but I think Valenti illustrates the problem. Once you start connecting people, and make your whole scenario off who might have known who under what circumstances, and go from, okay, they're not just persons of interest, but you make them, as my note here says, that Jack Valenti is a long-term CIA assassin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you asked me to describe who Jack Valenti was. That would have been the last part of any description I could possibly have thought of. I know of nothing that makes any sense out of that. But you just you start pulling things together, and
I mean, that's literally, that's so bad, Larry, quite honestly, to try. There's a lot of things you could put on Valenti's bio, but that's so bad that I think Judy Baker would have rejected it from her latest JFK book. I mean, that's how bad that is. You're going to put a rifle in the hand. And that's the other thing. They're putting a rifle in his hand. Not that he's coordinating stuff or controlling the media at that time, but putting, I mean, did I misunderstand something in that presentation? Putting a rifle in Jack Valenti's hand. Was that about right?
No, he's...
Okay.
And he apparently this is not the only time he's going to do it, because conceptually, the individual is going to make a case that he was also the sniper who shot Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh, okay. Why not? Sure.
So maybe he has more experience than we thought he did, or somehow. But I don't know. It's again, I'm trying to be a little sympathetic. It is, if you just dive into, and I'm following a thread on another subject on a forum. If you just dive into this,
yeah,
and you run across an article, and you start searching that article, you'll find another article that links to it.
Uh-huh.
And you could go on it, and you could end up being trapped in a case that different people have made and reinforced for each other, and not even realize what's happening to you. Because, mm-hmm. you know, one article is citing another, or citing another, or citing another. And if you get stuck in that line of thought, you can end up putting this collage, and maybe collage is the best thing together,
mm-hmm.
that makes sense based on what you read. But if you kind of expanded it out to the real world and studied those people independently in the real world, in the big world, it wouldn't. But you got yourself trapped. How can, even with the best intentions?
Well, see,
and I see that
with
people entering the scene. I think it's especially dangerous for people who are entering the scene
mm-hmm.
now, or the last 4 or 5 years, you know, to get trapped this way, because they you tend to get obsessed and you start linking those articles. You know, when I started 30 years ago, I mean, of all the things that could have happened to you, that couldn't have. You know,
you were
forced to take the longer route to doing things, to get documents, to read multiple books.
Yeah, but the thing is that a lot of times the older researchers would get caught, and they actually did research, would get caught up on pretty much trying to reinforce something that they read that sounded so plausible, so good, that's what they did. And look, I'm not going to call out names here, but I mean, a lot of people have based their work effectively on somebody else's thesis. And they would do that because they would fall in love with, and you know that there is a significant portion of not necessarily like, you know, way older guard researchers, but a couple of steps back from where we are today, Larry, that fell in love with David Lifton's book. Okay? And ever after, and I can't blame them because it's actually well written. It presents some startling stuff with some really interesting evidence for its time. The video he did, very compelling, very interesting, all that, but they fell in love with that scenario. And now what they've done is they've created a tunnel where they only have vision for his thesis. And some of them have just gone on to try and back him up. And that's it. I get that. But in the confusing landscape we're in today, you know, these people that call me onto their podcasts and things, I can be at one moment talking about Alan Dulles and at the next moment being asked about L. Ron Hubbard. And then Judy Baker, and then, you know, and so on. And then, oh, by the way, what about the guy who wrote, you know, the book about the Mossad did it? Now, none of these things are even remotely, related to each other, with the exception that they posit something other than the official story, which, look, I'm not a supporter of the official story. I have to say it all the time because I seem to be taking more time to cut down a lot of these unofficial stories. It's because there's more of them. But the funny thing about it to me is that you end up in a place where, indeed, you could connect all these things depending on your worldview. Some people could see it as a typical pedestrian sort of struggle in the American body politic, right? Where they view John Kennedy as a left-winger who was being opposed by right-wingers. And I'm not saying that that's completely invalid. What I'm saying is it's a little too superficial to explain a great deal of what went on, right? So I try not to get caught in these lenses where it's just, you know what, now you have to either prove or disprove some other thesis, and it can become this very, like, it sounds good altogether, because it's sort of what you want to hear. You want to hear, okay, you're anti-right wing, so you want to think about the evil right wingers striking down a hero of the people. Well, Kennedy may have been or may not have been, okay, which is where I always stand, is that, you know, these guys are always mixed bags. They're humans, first of all. But secondly, nobody in politics is black and white, really, no matter how they try and present themselves. You could view Kennedy as a cold warrior. You could view him as a progressive. You could view him as almost what a Republican might have been 30 years ago. Okay? You can't put him in current political terms, although people try to, because this does not look as it did then. I mean, would Kennedy even survive in today's Democratic Party? I don't know, but I mean to tell you that you can't study it that way and try and approach it that way.
I don't think today's Democratic Party would have survived in the 1963 Democratic Party.
No.
I've seen both of them.
Right.
But you're right. Call it tunnel vision, call it a lens. I guess what I take particular exception to, I mean, there's nothing wrong with saying that you're researching the Kennedy assassination or researching any event. But when you go, if you present that what you're doing is history, then you elevate it to a different standard. And there's there's no historian, or nobody should even claim to be describing history that hasn't done certain things. Anybody dealing with history would start with a literature search. And a literature search would immediately show you that there are six different views of this one thing, or 10 different views. And you're going to look at all of them, and you're going to have that in mind before you start doing your own work. You know, you know that there are going to be conflicts in facts. There are going to be conflicts in interpretations. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, histories take a long time to write. These days, somebody can jump in, and I'm pretty well convinced, write a book on any given conspiracy within 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. And that's really dangerous. I mean, that's the sort of thing that happens on the internet. I can jump in and start doing a podcast on the deep state, you know, 3 months after I heard there was one, mm-hmm. and expect people to take me seriously. Our time scale is accelerated so quickly, you know, that now that we accept that. Oh, how long have you been looking into that? Well, a couple of years, but I got it together. I understand it now.
Right.
Well, you know, I may be slower than most, but I just think it takes longer than that.
Well, I had a guy come to me not too long ago, and he showed me a manuscript and, you know, made me promise not to share it with anybody, and I did that. I went through it, and he said, you know, I want a guy like you to pull this apart. And I said, well, okay, I'm glad you came to me. And thank you. So I start going through this, and well, long story short, this book will not be published now because I told him effectively, you have no proof for many statements you're making. You got to show me something that is meaningful outside of an opinion. I mean, if you want to write a giant opinion piece, then describe it as that. But here's the thing. These people have gotten into a mindset where researching is just going around and looking at what Google has to say. And indeed, look, if you want to know how to change the oil in your truck and you don't know how, ask Google. That'll work. But if you're going to base your view of a subject that has been so examined on, I'm going to click on a link that I start with because I like the idea, and then I'm going to follow other suggestions after that, and you're going to let Google's algorithm determine for you what is tied together with that initial link that you started with, you are not going to come up with something that is valuable. You're going to regurgitate, okay, something that has already been done. And when you do that, okay, just like physical regurgitation, nobody should really honestly want to eat that after you vomit it back up. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. It doesn't have sustenance in it. It doesn't have anything new in it. It doesn't have any sort of, you know, well, I talked to 1-2 people. Okay, that's great. But I've seen people who've conducted 1,000 interviews to create a book that's 500 pages long. Because that's the kind of work you need to do. And not just talking to people and taking their hearsay, their oral histories, as the only history. Now, if that's exclusively what you're doing and laying it together, like in the case of William Mattson Law, you have created something of value. But if you are taking them and now extracting pieces of these so that you can write a narrative and base it on a couple of quotes here and there, most of which you didn't collect yourself, by the way, because you're taking it from video interviews, audios you heard, and in some cases, these people don't even properly know the source of the piece of media that they looked at. I mean, on a Dallas TV interview, and I'm like, yeah, I'm very familiar with that quote. That was actually done for a TV special in 1982, not 1964. You know, like, I know what this is. And oh, by the way, you got that guy's name wrong. And that's not who interviewed him. And that's not who produced it. They don't even adequately get the information that would have been well taught to us in school about, you know, writing a bibliography. You have to know where the book came from. You have to know who published it. right? What year it was released, who the author was, in order to enter it as, this was a source I used. That's in a grade school book report. Do that for me, at least, in the Kennedy assassination. Larry, I know I just ranted there, but do you object to anything I just said?
No, and I think it gets back to due diligence. I wish readers and listeners would exercise more due diligence. And I think that's what we're talking about, Chuck. And in regard to the whole body of work, and quite frankly, the whole body of what you encounter in the media these days,
mm-hmm.
you have to exercise due diligence, because I pretty much guarantee in most cases, in many cases, what you're going to encounter on in the media, they're not what they used to be. Mm-hmm. You used to have editors who were, you know, like mean and nasty and brutal, and reporters just, you know, lost their life trying to put stuff out when the editor would constantly be checking. And that's not happening these days. And as consumers of anything, whether it's in the JFK venue or anything else, we just have to be more demanding of ourselves to do some of the things that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. As an example, it strikes me, you can't come up with a scenario that intermixes sources that you took from 1963, you know, first day, first hour sources, and give equal weight to somebody that called into a radio show 25 years later. Yeah, you can't do that.
Oh, that's a specific.
If you do that without telling people, you know, the listener needs to say, where did that come from? Oh, well, I heard it. Somebody called into a radio show and said that they were behind the school book depository and they saw this. Oh, who are they? Well, they wouldn't give their name, but, you know, it's like, oh, come on now.
Well, especially when it's the same radio show that very famously had a guy on who claimed to be a time traveler. You know what I'm saying? And it described that he had a special mechanism in a truck that allowed him to travel through time. I mean, almost like it was, you know, Back to the Future over there, John Titor, right? I mean, literally, he's sourcing. Here's a witness. Somebody who called into Art Bell in this present. And I'm going, gee, I wonder if anybody ever called into Art Bell and maybe told him some BS on the air. Look, not a suitable source to be basing. You know, and I've seen other people who claim to be witnesses in Dealey Plaza, and I'm not going to go ahead and mention names. I mean, some people have passed on that, you know, we learned later, we're definitely illegitimate witnesses. Some people are still alive that I consider to be illegitimate witnesses. You and I, Larry, might disagree or agree on some of them. But simply because somebody said they were there, and simply because somebody said that they knew somebody, and you don't even know who that person is, you got a problem with your source. I mean, I could go on here and I could make all sorts of outlandish statements all day long. I defy somebody to prove some of the more outlandish things that I've said on here to be inaccurate. Go ahead. If you can, then I'll question my own memory. But when somebody claims to be in the proximity of a particular historical event or a historical figure, I got to tell you, I want to see more than just their word as proof. And certainly somebody deciding to call in to a radio show, as I well know, sometimes people call in and make prank calls. Sometimes people call in and just want to create a bit of a stir, and they do that. I've heard people call into radio shows, Larry, who say, you know, the end of the world is coming. It'll be next Thursday. I've heard that. Not on Art Bell, but on another radio show. I'm not going to name. But, yeah. Okay. It didn't mean that I was planning for my last days on Earth, because it's somebody who doesn't have to identify themselves calling into a radio station who could have a variety of motives. That is not a witness statement. Okay. And I'm not saying that you got to go to the official record all the time. Sometimes you can go right to the person. Sometimes you can go and get something that was memorialized, something the person wrote. Yes, indeed, you could do that, and you got to verify that documentation or that recording as well. See, again, it's all about due diligence. The scary thing is not necessarily that there's people out there trying to do this, right? Because you and I dealt with the whole, well, Kennedy was assassinated because he was going to reveal the existence of Area 51 and aliens. We dealt with that, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
And I still deal with it, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's never going away. I know that. I can accept that.
But it sounds almost like a viable concept. It does, right? Because if there was a reason to get rid of somebody, it might be to shut them up. I mean, that's typical. I mean, that's the way a lot of organizations, including our own government, function sometimes. Hmm? So you could say, well, that's a reasonable method. That's a reasonable motive, maybe. Okay. Is there opportunity? Well, of course, the government or the agencies that are involved in that kind of thing, could they have the opportunity to lay their hands on the president or lay a bullet on him? Oh, yeah, sure. Let's go for it. Now you got a problem, though, and it's called evidence. You got to back all that up. I mean, I can create other reasonable scenarios, too, that might sound really good to somebody. You know, they had to get rid of him because they were going to fake the moon landing, if you think the moon landing was faked.
Hmm. And at least if you're going to do that, I think at least Jim Mars, I think at least did it in a reasonable fashion. It's like, okay, mm-hmm. I'm going to write this book called Crossfire, and I'm going to give you the information that says, you know, the official story of what happened is questionable. Okay, very, very likely that it wasn't a lone gunman. It wasn't, you know, okay. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to give you, like, four or five possibilities, and I'm going to explore those. So he explores Johnson, he explores the Mafia, he explores the right wing, and kind of gives you a case study how any of those scenarios could work.
Right.
But he doesn't pick one. You know, at least that is educational, and it gives you a good survey, and it doesn't trap you into anything.
Right.
And I thought that was a very credible way to approach it. It, Jim didn't just pick one. He gave you an overview. And I think...
No, and I would still consider Crossfire.
Said, there are many scenarios. I could probably think of 15 and come up with three more, if you give me 5 minutes, of scenarios that could conceivably work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that just leads you into, in any event, that's kind of looking at, like, looking at pictures of people in Dealey Plaza.
Yes. Well, but you know what? I would still consider Crossfire a useful book. Because,
yes, I would too.
You know, some of the information is outdated and has been debunked. Fair enough. Some of it has been contradicted or challenged with other information since its publication. But it does present a wide-ranging view of possibilities all in one place. See, again, like I said, just taking witness statements, you know, okay, so that's not good enough, Chuck. Yeah, but I would still tell you, read in the Eye of History, because this collection of individuals who are directly involved in things is a useful tool in and of itself. And if you're setting out to do that, fine. That's great. But when you're trying to tell me you've got the situation, you've got the case solved, I'm sorry, you're going to have to lay this out. I don't go exactly with the legal concept of how you have to lay out and enter your evidence, but I kind of do, I guess, because you can't just pull it out of thin air. You can't just say, here's a picture, this looks like this guy, therefore he was there. No, you're going to have to verify for me that, A, there isn't proof he was somewhere else, like in the case of Johnny Roselli being in Dealey Plaza. Problems. Okay, emerge there if you assume that he slipped the FBI, the mob didn't know where he was, the FBI didn't know where he was, okay, because they were monitoring exactly where he was at that time. So, you know, there's a problem right there. Plus, find me photographic evidence. It doesn't exist. Oh, all that's been altered. Okay, all the FBI files have been altered. Okay, look. There's a lot of different ways to go, and there's a lot of loose ends, and I get it, but we're not going to tie them down by, again, asking Google. It's not going to work, and this is more for the reader than even the writer or the the BS artist who is going to put out their solution. And there are a lot of them. Okay? And I would even look back at some of the people that were sort of lauded at certain points, giving you the mob did it scenario until their scenario fell apart because there is contradictory evidence, not just in official hands, but elsewhere, that mean your scenario doesn't come together. Your mob scenario doesn't come together. It just doesn't work. Happens with a lot of things. Okay? And it's happened over and over again. I mean, I've mentioned it over and over about the French gunman thing. Where, you know what? At a certain point, with limited information, maybe Christian David had a point. But Steve Rebell and everybody else learned not so much. Right? And debunking the whole corridor through Montreal, again, something I was directly involved in. So, you know, it doesn't work. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And you're not going to make it work with a bunch of hearsay and working off of other people. You know, if all you got as a reference is somebody else's book, who might have also, let's just say, on the benign side of things, made mistakes, and not just been trying to fill in their own gaps in another way and just been dishonest, or maybe somebody who had a good contract to make some money at a certain point. I mean, that's not the case anymore. I don't know who's going to get the next $1 million contract. I think they ran out of those a couple years ago. Bugliosi might have taken the last one of those to his grave. You know what I'm saying? This is
I've not seen anybody show up with one lately, but I will add one thing. Again, from the consumer for these things, if you're listening to them, think about this also. In a lot of instances, someone coming up with a scenario like this constantly makes reference to the fact that everything has been altered. You know, I've got the right story. Yes, you brought up this fact. You brought up this document. You got this or that. But, of course, that was altered. So, you know, like, I'm a really smart person. I know it was altered. How do you know it was altered? Well, because it can't be true because it doesn't agree with my scenario. I would just like listeners to think about this. We deal with tens of thousands of pages of everyday documents that were exchanged within the CIA, within the FBI, within the military, within all parts of government. Okay. That's just their routine daily job. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to accept the fact that, you know, did somebody know before the fact that, you know, to insert wrong documents and wrong information into this regular day-to-day correspondence so that it would turn up later and cover up something? You know, was it that complex? Did they, you know, after the fact, suddenly discover or, you know, were in charge of, and they had to make up lots and lots of documents and, like, Roselli's, okay, we're going to have to redo the FBI surveillance tapes and the informants who were tracking Roselli today. We're going to redo that, retype those reports, make all the old ones go away. Because, you know, we let that happen, and now Johnny, we got to get Johnny out of trouble. I see that all the time. Now, if somebody can give me a case of where a document has been manufactured and go to the right time and place, or I personally tend to be more of a fan of documents being made to go away because that's simpler.
Right. But it's more efficient.
You've got to support your case for somebody having manufactured something.
But, Larry, it's more efficient and less troublesome to simply disappear evidence as opposed to manufacturing it.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, and that's easy. And you don't even have to know what's going on. It's like, man, I don't know what is going on here. It looks like there was a conspiracy. This could be really embarrassing. Let's just take all those Oswald Falls from New Orleans and ditch them. Okay. I mean, because we know, without a doubt, those sorts of things happen.
Well, right.
We know that the FBI did destroy a note from my, you know, we know destruction happened.
Well, I was just going to go there. I got two words for you if you don't believe that the destroy the evidence scenario is better, and they are James Hostie. Okay, which is pretty simple. To this day, Larry, you and I do not know the contents of the note that this guy said he flushed, which appears to be the truth. he was told to get rid of this and got rid of it, and that's it. Do we know the content of it? No, we have the speculation. We have, a typist or a secretary who gave some sort of testimony about what the content of that note might have been. We have we have Hostie's word in his book. We have Hostie's word in his interviews. We don't have that document, do we?
Nope.
So,
And equal one would be the evidence list out of Dallas that the FBI sent back to Dallas and said, okay, Dallas FBI office, you have two... options. You can explain how you totally screwed up and why what we're sending back is far less than we sent you, and you can explain that, or you can just renumber your evidence list. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, I think that's another classic example of, yeah, what happens after the fact is you make things go away. You don't.
Which, by the way, for people that don't know,
before the fact, you do it after the fact.
For people that don't know, just really quickly before we end, because we're all the way through the hour, Larry. For people that don't know, in Dallas, when the police collected all this evidence, I mean everything from Oswald's flip-flops to, to the casings, to the rifle, all this stuff, it was boxed up and sent to Washington. And when it came back, I mean, from all accounts, not the same exact things, not the same number of things came back. Very simple.
Just one addendum, Chuck.
Yeah.
They did this in mass, and when the police pulled everything out of the Payne's house,
yeah,
including a lot of the Payne's personal belongings and photos, and nobody took the trouble to note, oh, this was Oswald, this was Ruth, this was Michael, this was a third cousin's. It just all got thrown into boxes and sent off. You know, the whole, you couldn't expect a messier situation. So
no.
Can we really wonder why 50 plus years after the fact, we're still debating the Minox camera? You know?
Yeah.
You know, given that kind of police performance, and then it's not even kept in Dallas. It's all shipped out, you know?
Right.
No wonder. you gotta give a lot of credit to, like, you know, poor techniques.
No, absolutely true. And, you know, last word on that, if you don't mind, is that, I mean, they collected a whole bunch of inane things as well. I mean, there's like Oswald's sweatshirt, maybe. Not sure if it was his. And just like that camera, was that Michael Payne's or was that Lee Harvey Oswald's? We're still asking these questions. There's a whole book on just that, by the way, called Mrs. Payne's Garage, which, again, it's a narrow focus, but I would suggest people read it. I mean, just to get an idea about what Larry was just talking about. Larry, I know I dragged you through this mud here, and I appreciate you taking the time, but, I mean, in general, we needed to address this because I'm so, so tired of, well... You know, they resurrect and contort the old bad theories back around again continuously. This is why I started the whole myth series. I mean, even the driver shot Kennedy, right? Which is where I'll conclude here. The driver shot Kennedy. All right, so you answer it by saying, listen, we didn't have a clear Zapruder film back then. Somebody might have seen those blurs and thought that's what they saw. Okay, benign explanation. Move on. Then somebody says, well, the film was altered. And you go, yeah, okay, maybe, but not this. And then they tell you, well, not only was the film altered, but there's other evidence that supports the driver shot him. Somebody smelled gunpowder, etc. They will continue contorting back to it, no matter what you do. And I think part of the responsibility lies with, yeah, the people that will continue to resurrect and keep, exhuming these long-dead theories. And unfortunately, yeah, it's a big challenge to somebody says, you know, I'm interested in the Kennedy assassination. Let me search the Internet. God help you. God help you. Larry Hancock, larry-hancock.com, that is your website. Of course, I'll give links and also give links to some of the books that Larry wrote about, none of which we talked about tonight, but in general, I'm sorry, I brought you on like a little bit of a bitch fest here to complain about these common problems in this newly emerging media out there on the Kennedy assassination. And I'm sorry, Larry, but I may also invite you into a new myths episode, which I might have to do a whole 2 hours on this guy's presentation alone, the one that we shared. Because, I mean, it's just loaded. Jack Valenti's your assassin. You heard it here, folks. Or maybe you didn't. Anyway, Larry Hancock, thanks for doing this with me.
It was good to be back, Chuck.
And we will see you again in 2 weeks, and I'll see all of you tomorrow night. Of course, thanks to Mike Swanson for being on the first hour. And I know that was a strange hour, but hey, we're going in different directions nowadays. I am Emilio Celli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.